I'm going to study the book of Haggai, but before we do that, I want to look at the background of the book as set forth in Ezra. Now, in our last study, the last book we studied, Habakkuk, just before the Babylonian captivity, and that would be about 620 to 605 or 6 along there, B.C. Now, we're after the captivity, and the remnant has come back to Judea, and they laid the foundation of the temple, but did not go beyond that. So God calls Haggai and Zechariah to stir up the people and get the job done. Well, I want to look at the background of that before we go on, but look at a few dates here. I think it's always good to keep dates in your mind when you're studying the Bible. Right now, here with the captivity. Captivity was 586. 586, they were carried away into captivity. Now then, Cyrus overthrew Babylon and issued a decree that in 539, issued a decree that they could all return. So the return took place from the captivity in 536. That means they were actually in captivity 50 years. But the 70 years goes back to 605 when the first group was carried away, or 6. Well, that down to here gives you your 70 years. Then you have another 70 years. They came back in 536 with a return, but they only laid the foundation of the building and did not complete the building of the temple, the building of the temple, until 516. So here, from the destruction of the temple to the rebuilding, was 70 years. Here, the time of the first captivity to the return was 70 years. So we've got two 70-year periods here to keep in mind when you're studying the Bible. Now, a lot of folk wonder, how can you have them in captivity 50 years when Jeremiah said to be 70 years? Well, it was 70. From the first captivity in 605 and 6 to 536 when they came back was 70 years. They were without a temple from 586 when the temple was destroyed, 516 when they completed it. Now, the point is here, they came back in 536. Well, that gives you 20 years here before they completed the building, the temple. Now, Cyrus sent them back to build the temple. Now, turn with me to Ezra, the first chapter, and let's get the background now of this return of the people. And the last paragraph of 2 Chronicles, and the first or the last part of it there, and the first of Ezra are the same. So it generally thought that Ezra wrote the Chronicles and then wrote Ezra, but I don't know whether he did or not. It doesn't matter. But let's read Ezra. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Jehovah by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, Jehovah stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and put it also in writing, saying, thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth hath Jehovah, the God of heaven, given me, and he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whosoever therefore is among you of all his people, his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of Jehovah, the God of Israel, his God, which is in Jerusalem. Whosoever is left in any place where he sojourneth, that the men in his place help with silver, with gold, and with goods, freewill offering and so on. Right, so now they come back and look down here to verse 7. Cyrus the king brought forth the vessels of the house of Jehovah, which Nebuchadnezzar had brought forth out of Jerusalem, and put them in the house of his God. Now Cyrus gave these vessels back to the Jews, carried back with them to Judea, to Judah, and put in the temple when they rebuilt it there. Now here's a name here that I've got to explain a little bit, I guess. Jump down to verse 8. Even those did Cyrus, king of Persia, bring forth by the hand of Mithridath, the treasurer, and numbered them unto Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. Now you've got this name Sheshbazzar. Well, who is Sheshbazzar? Alright, let's look in just a moment. As you look at that bazaar, you naturally think of Nebuchadnezzar. You think of that as maybe a Babylonian or Persian name. But now let's jump on down here just a little bit to verse 2. And here he says in Judah, Jerusalem and Judah, to a city who came with Zerubbabel, Joshua, Nehemiah, and so on. And that's not our Nehemiah of the book of Nehemiah. It's just another thought, just a name there. Right? And so he has Zerubbabel. Now you've got these two men here, Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel. Alright, now it says in one place, now let me move on over here into the second chapter, if you will please now, turn with me to the second chapter, and drop down here to about, let's drop down to verse 10, I'll not read all of that, start verse 6. On the first day of the seventh month began they to offer burnt offerings unto Jehovah, but the foundation of the temple of Jehovah was not yet laid. Now the first thing they did back here in verse 2 was to build the altar. So when they got back in 536 here, in this particular year, they built the altar unto Jehovah, and they also laid the foundation of the temple. That's as far as they went. They built an altar and offered sacrifices, but didn't go any further. All right, and now come on down to verse 10. When the builders laid the foundation of the temple of Jehovah, they set the priests and so on. Now drop down to verse 11. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised Jehovah, because the foundation of the house of Jehovah was laid. But men of the priests and Levites and heads of fathers, those older men, the old men that had seen the first house, that was Solomon's temple, when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, wept with a loud voice. And many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted and wept. Well, now the older people who had seen the temple that had been carried away 50 years before, brought back now, as a young people, they had remembered that temple, and it was so magnificent that when you laid the foundation of this one, why, it looked like nothing compared to the other one. So they wept, but the younger ones were so glad to be back, they shouted for joy. So we got a mixture there in that. But all they did was lay the foundation. Now, this is the thing we want to note here. All right, and now, moving on over here now to chapter 5 now, chapter 5 of Ezra. Now the prophet Haggai, and that's one we're going to study now in Zechariah next time. Now the prophet Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem, in the name of the God of Israel, prophesied they unto them. Then rose up Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, and began to build the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. So now this is, we'll get to his date in just a moment. There were really 520 is when it is. Right, so here then, in 520, now that this is when Haggai begins to prophet. Haggai and Zechariah began to prophesy in 520. Well, that means they've been back 16 years now, and only laid the foundation and hadn't done anything about it. And just left it there. I want to come back to Sheshbazzar for just a moment. The fifth chapter. Now, move on over here to about verse 12, I guess. I don't want to try to read too much. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the Chaldean, who destroyed the house and carried the people away. But in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, Cyrus king made a decree to build this house to God. All right, now come down here to verse, about the middle of verse 14, where it says, thus those did Cyrus, the king, take out of the temple of Babylon, and they were delivered unto one whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he had made governor. Now drop down to 16. Then came the same Sheshbazzar, and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. And since the time even until now have it been in building, and yet it is not completed. Right? So back in the early chapter, it was Zerubbabel who began it, who laid the foundation. Here is Sheshbazzar that laid the foundation. Well, fortunately, Zechariah has cleared that up for us. And now Zechariah, the fourth chapter, that's our next, just hold your place back there, though, but turn to this if you want to. Fourth chapter, Zechariah in verse 9. The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hand shall also finish it, and thou shalt know that Jehovah of hosts has sent me unto you. Right? One passage says that Sheshbazzar laid the foundation. The other says that Zerubbabel laid the foundation. Well, I think that the answer to that is that Sheshbazzar was probably his Persian or Babylonian name, whereas this one, Zerubbabel, was his Jewish name. Because you'll notice here, Sheshbazzar, Nebuchadnezzar, and Nabopolassar, all of those different fellows that ended in Z-A-R, suggest unto us that Belshazzar was simply a name given him by Cyrus, or his name when he lived in over there in Babylon. But the other was his Jewish name. Now that is the best explanation. In fact, I think that is the explanation, because when you have Zechariah's statement there, he just says very flatly that Zerubbabel laid the foundation, Zerubbabel will build, put on the top stone there. Right? Whereas in Ezra, who came from Babylon and would be familiar with his Babylonian name, he simply says, calls him Sheshbazzar. Right? Now, I'm saying that, it's not that it's a very important point, but it, nevertheless, it clears up something that if you're studying this, and someday you may want to get these tapes out and go back and study this material. Well, if you do, then you have it on the tape anyway. All right, now let's go back now to Ezra. Now, look in the sixth chapter. Now, in the sixth chapter, verse 14, begin with verse 14. And the elders of the Jews builded and prospered through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. And they builded and finished it according to the commandment of the God of Israel, and according to the decree of Cyrus and Darius and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. And the house was finished in the third day of the month Adar, which was in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. All right. Now let me go back here. Darius began to reign in 522. I said Darius, his reign began in 522. Alright, now go back, turn with me now to Haggai, first verse there. You know what Haggai says? That was in the second year of Darius. And now the first verse. In the second year of Darius, the king, in the sixth month, first day of the month, came the word of Jehovah by Haggai the prophet, unto Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, saying, Thus speaketh Jehovah of hosts, saying, This people say, It is not the time for us to come, the time for Jehovah's house to be built. Then came the word of Jehovah to Haggai by the prophet, saying, Is it a time for you to build your sealed houses? Well, let me look at this now. All right, so here then, 522, now second year would be 520. All right, now then the sixth year would be 516, that'd be 4 years after this. So that's the second year, now the sixth year, that would be 516. So this is where we get our dates here, you see. Cyrus, Darius, 522, the second year would be 520. Now then the sixth year, they completed it, 516. So you have here from 586 when it was destroyed to 516 when you have it completed, there, a 7 year period when they were without the temple. Now, did I confuse you, or did I make that clear enough for you to understand it? No?
Then
wouldn't
these vessels be the same ones that
have
the handwriting on the wall?
No, that was Belshazzar.
Yeah, but would these vessels that they gave to them, could they have been the same ones that
covered
the handwriting?
Oh, the vessels you're talking about?
Yeah, the vessels. Oh, yeah, the vessels, yeah. Would be the same. They were probably glad to get rid of them if they remembered.
Well, it might have been. I hadn't thought about that. Yes, Belshazzar brought out those vessels, you remember, who were praising his gods when Cyrus took the city. However, Cyrus would maybe think that was a good omen, so he was the one allowed him to take them back. He said, no, I think what he really was trying to do, Cyrus, according to the issue in Chronicles there, he sent all these people back to their homes. Now, Assyria and Babylon, when they conquered a people, wherever it was, They would carry those people near over their land. Then they would take other conquered people and bring them down here, you see. Well, now, Cyrus reversed that. Cyrus, as all I read about Cyrus, and not a great deal known about it, but I think I read practically everything, just one little old book that I had about it. But everything I know about Cyrus, he was a great man. I think a lot of him personally. He was a polygamist. He worshipped, polygamist. No, not polygamist. Worshipped of many gods, what it's called. Polytheism. Yeah, wasn't a polygamist. Both of them. Yeah, he was a polytheist. He was a worshipper of many gods. So what he wanted to do, he was sending these people back to their homes to build temples to the gods that they'd already worshipped, that they might pray to these gods on his behalf. So he was doing it. He wanted all those gods to be favorable toward him. So that's why he sent the Jews back to build his temple. That was his order. You go back and build a temple. You have that, you remember, in the, like, he's called in the 45th chapter of Isaiah, he's called Cyrus, my anointed one. Now, Isaiah never called him God's servant. Jeremiah does. He called him a number of times. He speaks of Cyrus as the servant of Jehovah. So he was Jehovah's servant. God raised him up and used him there. So now then, he wants them to go back. And so they got back, but they didn't do what they came back to do. That's why God raised up Haggai and Zechariah to stir up the people, get this job done, get the temple built here. And God's not going to bless them until they do. So this is the purpose of these two men. Haggai, a little short book of two chapters. Zechariah is a much longer book, much more difficult book. I think we'll enjoy it, but it's very difficult. All right, now I've made everything clear. Everybody got, all right. I know those names are numbers are a little confusing, but if you just keep in mind here that the first captivity on Nebuchadnezzar was 605 B.C. That's when he carried away Daniel and his friends. Then he came back in 597. He carried away Ezekiel and 10,000 as hostages. Then when Zedekiah, the king whom he set up in Jerusalem, rebelled against him, he came back and destroyed the city here and the temple and carried away the big group captivity. And here's where you have the captivity and the destruction of the temple. Destruction of the temple here, 586. Right now, Cyrus overthrew Babylon in 539. Then he issued a decree a year later that they could all go home, but apparently it took time for them to make preparation and all of that, because it was 536 when they got back. Right now, they laid the foundation here and built an altar, and that's all they did. Now then in 520, the second year of Darius, who followed Cyrus, now when he comes in, why, then he is in the second year, and he also helped and gave himself, but in the second year of his reign, well, that's when second year of his reign, why, they began to build the temple. 4 years later, in the sixth year, they had the temple completed. So it was without a temple from 586 to 516. Now, you remember that they could not offer burnt sacrifice anywhere except in Jerusalem. So therefore, when they were in Babylon, that's when the synagogue arose. They built synagogues, and that just simply means places of assembly, places of meeting. So they would meet there and worship. It was song and things of that nature. But they didn't, they couldn't offer sacrifices. So without that, come out, answer. Without the sacrifices, God couldn't bless them. So now it's very imperative that they complete this temple. We're in the book of Haggai, so just starting it this morning. And, right now let me say just a word about Haggai. He doesn't have the rumbling and the rolling and the rhythm that Nahum had. He doesn't have the poetic way of expressing that Habakkuk had. He doesn't have that way of Amos there, of getting the thing done and speaking as he did there. He doesn't have that power that he had. He simply reminds me of an individual. I've known preachers like that. A preacher that is just a humble fellow that he just has one theme, but he knows how to preach it. And he can do that. And he's a humble man. He has no oratory, no eloquence about him. Just straightforward, get the job done. Now, here's an interesting thing about the book of Haggai. 26 times out of the 38 verses of that little book, he used the expression, saith Jehovah, or Jehovah said, or the word of Jehovah came unto me. In other words, he ascribes everything he says to Jehovah. It's the word of Jehovah. It's God speaking through him. That got the job done. That has impressed me. That's the only way you can get God's word done today, is by thus saith Jehovah, thus saith the Lord. Let God do the speaking, and not us try to use our oratory, wisdom and our psychology and our philosophy and all that sort of thing. That doesn't get it done. It's the word of God. And this man, that's a redeeming, that's the power. That's the power of his work. God said it, you get busy and do it. And he got the job done. That little book has impressed me that if you want to get God's work done, let God do the speaking. Let us keep in the background. Us preachers stay in the background. That's where it belongs anyway. Let the word of God do the job. If that doesn't get it done, we're not going to get it done anyway. It won't be God's work when we get through. I think that's interesting. 26 times he makes that claim, that and the allusion to that in this little book here. And so he's a man of a one-track mind. He's just got one message. Build the temple. Nahum had one message. God's going to destroy Nineveh. Others have more than that. But these two men had only one message to the people. And that was, God's going to destroy Nineveh or build the temple. And now we're going to start reading it in just about a minute here, I think. All right, and that at least got it done. And so we've looked at the background, and we're ready now to start reading it. All right, now I'm going to read again from the first verse. In the second year of Darius, and that would be 520, the king in the sixth month, in the first day of the month. Now, Haggai, I think three or four little speeches here, but he dates every one of them. All right, the first day of the month came the word of Jehovah by Haggai. Now, the word Haggai means festival, probably from a longer word means festival of Jehovah, but the word Haggai simply means festival. So if we're going to have a festival of Jehovah, let's get the job done. Right, the prophet under Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and he was the governor, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, said. Now why did he address them in particular? Because Zerubbabel was the governor. He led the people. Joshua, the high priest, who should have moved them religiously, they had neglected their job. Been back here 16 years now, and you came back to build a temple to Jehovah. All you've done is lay the foundation of the building and set up the altar. So now then, he addresses them as being responsible for this delay. Now he turns to the people in just a moment. Thus speaketh Jehovah of hosts, saying, this people say. Now notice he calls them this people. He doesn't say my people. I heard this people say, and this house. He's not ready to claim them or it until they do his will. They came back to do it. Until they do that, he didn't see fit to claim them as his people. This people say, it is not the time for us to come, the time for Jehovah's house to be built. Then came the word of Jehovah by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it a time for you yourself to dwell in your sealed houses while this house lieth waste? This people and this house. Now what have they done? You're dwelling in sealed houses. In other words, you came back and you took the lumber, the timber, the stone, whatever you might have used in the temple. You built your own houses. And now then you've left my house out here in this condition. You haven't rebuilt it. That suggests what ought to come first. The house of God, the work of God. I don't mean this building we're sitting in. I'm talking about God's house, the church, the spiritual house. That ought to come first before our own personal convenience and comforts and those things. Now, which do we put first? Well, each one of us has to decide that. I can't decide it for you for me. You can decide which you're putting first. I can decide which I'm putting first. God's house ought to come first. My own next. God always has the first place. While this house lies waste. Now, therefore, thus saith Jehovah of hosts, consider your ways. Now, stop and take a look at you and your ways, the way you've been doing things. You have sown much and bring in little. You eat, but you have not enough. You drink, but you are not filled with drink. You clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earns wages to put it into a bag with holes. All right? So here you haven't been blessed in your crops, you haven't been blessed in your vineyard, you haven't been blessed in your salary. Probably inflation was taking it all up there because they were not raising much, so what they would have, inflation would eat it up. But God said, what you earn, you're putting in a bag with holes in it. I used to think that applied to me pretty well. It's like I could never get ahead. I just, everything I earned, it went for something. And put it in a bag with holes in it. I don't know whether yours got away like that or not. But all right, so now that's his first address to them now on this. And he goes on in this same first address. Now, thus saith Jehovah of hosts, consider your ways. Now, that's the second time he says that. Consider your ways. Look at what you're doing and how it's turning out. Go up to the mountain and bring wood and build a house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, saith Jehovah. Right? Now, what that mountain, it's plural in some places. Some it's plural, but not here. Maybe, I don't know if the mountains of Judah, I don't think there was a temple there. But probably it was a Mount Lebanon to the north where Solomon had gotten his temple to build the first temple. But anyway, you go to the mountain and get, I think it's Mount Lebanon, you go to the mountain and get the timbers, start building this. And I'll be glorified, said Jehovah. Now look, you looked for much, and lo, it came to little. And when you brought it home, I did blow upon it. So what little you brought home, I blew upon it. I scattered it like chaff, scattered it away. Well, now, what's God teaching you? You came back here for purpose. I raised up Cyrus to deliver you. Cyrus told you to come back and build a house. You came back. You've been back here 16 years. And all you've done is lay the foundation, build an altar, and then built your own houses and looked to yourselves. That's all you've done. Well, I said a while ago, that looks like a lot of folks, maybe we all know, maybe each one of us, looking to ourselves. So you do your own considering. I'm not doing it for you, I'm doing it for myself. Right? I did blow up on that. Why? Why, saith Jehovah of hosts? Because of my house that lieth waste, while you run every man to his own house. My house lies waste. You're concerned only with your house. I think I preached on that one time when I thought it was needed. I used that as a text. I know I had a friend that had a good sermon on that. I never heard it. He told me about it. We talked about it. But now, here you're running to your own business looking after it while my house lies waste. While the house of God, the church of the Lord, the people of God, his spiritual temple, oftentimes we neglect it and let it lie waste while we're so busy building our own business, our own houses, and enjoying our vacations and all that sort of thing. It's a good lesson to those who need it. But now therefore, for your sake, the heavens withhold the dew, and the earth withholdeth its fruit, because you have put the wrong things first. While therefore the heavens withhold the dew, now remember that dew in Palestine, in the summer months, the dry months, they had the early rains and the latter rains. But in the summer, no rain, but they had heavy dews. Those heavy dew, the plants, things that grew, that grain, all that depended on those heavy dews for life. But when the heavens withheld the dew and withheld the rain both, why then, they didn't get anything. So when they go out, now look at this next one here. I call for a drought upon the land and upon the mountains and upon the grain and upon the new wine and upon the oil and upon that which the ground bringeth forth and upon men and upon cattle and upon all the labor of the hands. When I call the drought. That's an interesting thing to study the Old Testament, isn't it? How often God sends this tornado, the storm, or God withholds the rain and the dew. In other words, demonstrates back there an exercise over the forces of nature. And Elihu, in the book of Job, 36th chapter, does the same thing. He points out that this is of Jehovah here, the storm, the works of Jehovah, the clouds, the lightning, the thunder, all of that. And Jehovah's speech to Job, the same thing, indicates that. So as you study the Old Testament, you see the hand of God in the forces of nature. I am not prepared to say the extent to which God's hand operates in the realm of nature today. I have my personal opinion on it, personal view of it. But I don't I try to keep it personal because I don't have a direct statement in the New Testament that indicates that exactly. So we're just... But at any rate, God controlled his control. I think he still does. I just wouldn't say it. I think God still does. I think God still controls these matters. When a nation reaches the point that it's leaving God completely out of its thinking, why then you have these expressions of nature as warnings that God is still in control. I've mentioned this several times when I've said I think that the seven trumpets of Revelation are minor judgments to warn the people. They're warning judgments of that which will come unless there is a change. And unless there's a change, then I'll send a judgment that will occur to have. I'll send you a judgment that will be one real judgment. Well, I think that's what we have in our own country. I think a lot of these things that God allows or sends, whichever one you want to use there, they're simply warnings to us. Droughts in some areas, hurricanes in other areas, cyclones in other parts of the country, floods over yonder somewhere else. Well, God is simply saying, I'm still in control. Now, the very fact that the nation has left God out of his thinking, I think these are heralds of a greater judgment that will come upon it when God sees fit to send it. But we'll leave that with him. I'm not saying when that'll be. I'm not saying how it'll be. I'm saying it will be. Unless there's a turning, there will be that. I think the whole of the Bible clearly teaches that, Old and New Testament. All right? So here then, I'll send the cattle and all labor of the land. Hands. Then Zerubbabel. Now, look, that sermon got results. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of Jehovah their God and the words of Haggai the prophet, as Jehovah their God had sent him, and the people did fear before Jehovah. All right, now one sermon. Man, I've read that a lot of times, but wouldn't that be wonderful? I could preach one sermon, get that kind of action, that kind of results from it. But about like Pentecost, 3,000 baptized under one, obeyed the gospel under one sermon. Today you got about 3,000 sermons to baptize one person. Would have made a complete turnaround there, it seems to me. So here one sermon got results. Well, they knew he was speaking from God. They knew that was true. It was so. All right, so fear that. But I want you to know the remnant. Now here's another point I want to observe. I'm not going to go into that in detail. I may do it later in Zechariah. But in this remnant, God had promised in Isaiah, 20th chapter, 21st verse, I believe it is, and also in Jeremiah, that he would bring back a remnant. Now, all that God ever promised to bring back from the captivity was a remnant. He never promised to bring all the people back. He won't bring back a remnant. Now, of the five books that are written after his return there, Ezra and Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, those are five books written afterwards. The remnant is mentioned in Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, and Zechariah. I believe Malachi is the only one who didn't mention it. Didn't mention the remnant. But four of the five books mentioned the remnant that came back. Only a remnant came back. God never promised they would all come back. He only promised also there'd be a remnant of the Jews saved under the Messiah. And Paul said in Romans 11 and verse 5, even now there is a remnant according to the election of grace. I'm saying that to say this. God never promised that all the Jews were going to be saved. He never promised that when Christ coming back, all the Jews were going to be saved. God never made us a promise of that. No, the Jews are under the gospel of Christ today just as the Gentiles are. They accept it and obey it, or they reject it, one or the other. And all of them do that. And so God has not had done anything for the Jew now or tomorrow or before the end of time. He doesn't have for the Gentile. He doesn't have anything for the Gentile, but he isn't free for the Jew also. And God, when Christ died and the law was taken out of the way and Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD and the genealogies were all destroyed there, they were casted out, why, God was through with them. God was through with them as a people of his. Now, I will say this from Jeremiah 30 and verse 11. God said, of all the nations where I scatter thee, I'll bring to a full end. But I will not bring thee, the Jews, to a full end. But I will punish you, or whatever he says there. In measure. Alright? God has promised never to bring them to a full end. The Jews as a people will never be brought to a full end. They will always be just distinguishable in one generation as they were in another. But they'll never again be a nation. For when God destroyed that nation, brought it to an end, no more would one, a descendant of Konah, sit upon the throne of David and ruling in Judah and prospering, Jeremiah said. So that's brought to an end. And I'm saying that because we've got all this confusion today among people on this question. All right, so now he's going on to say here, then Jehovah stirred up the spirit, and they went to work then. In the four, where did I stop here? And Jehovah stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and the governor, and the high priest. And, all right, and the 24th day, in the month, sixth month, in the second year of Darius the king. So we're back again to this second year here. The second year of Darius the king here will be 520. So this sermon stirred them up and put them to work. Now they're going to rebuild that temple. It took them 4 years to do it, but they rebuilt it anyway. Right now, in the seventh month, in the 21st day of the month, came the word of Jehovah to Haggai, by Haggai the prophet's sake. All right, now this is in the seventh month. This one back here, the first one there, was the first day of the sixth month. So this is just a few weeks later. That would be the first day, and this is in the seventh month here. 20, a little over a month, about a month and a few weeks, isn't it? All right, now he speaks again. Speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and to the remnant of the people saved. They've got your remnant there three times, back up there in verse 12, and the remnant. Then you come on down here to verse 14 there, high priest and the spirit, all the remnant of the people. Now down here in verse 2, to the remnant of the people saved. So the emphasis there is to the remnant of the people. Now you have the same thing in Nehemiah. When Nehemiah, a person, returned from Babylon and told him how the remnant were getting along over there. The remnant's always the people of God. I want to pay attention to him. All right, now here, the remnant of the people saying, who is left among you that saw this house in the form of glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes as nothing? Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel. Now notice this exhortation here. Now here's Jehovah's promise. A wonderful power. Now they're discouraged over this. They're trying to build it. They're slow with it. They're having opposition. Their food is scarce. Everything is look like in a total depression. And yet God tells them to go and build this temple. All right? So now then, God gives them this word of encouragement. Now notice what it is here. As we look at it. Say now, be strong, O Zerubbabel, said Jehovah, and be strong, O Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and be strong, O ye people of the land, said Jehovah, and work, for I am with you, said Jehovah of hosts. That's a great passage. Be strong, governor, be strong, high priest, be strong, all ye people, and work, for Jehovah be with you. Now, as Paul said in Ephesians, the sixth chapter, be strong in the Lord and the strength of his might. That's what they would be strong in. Be strong in me, but I'm telling you what to do. You be strong and work. All right? So, not only strong, be strong isn't enough, but we got to use that. Be strong and work, says Jehovah. Now notice further here, says Jehovah, quote, according to the word that I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, my spirit abode among you, fear ye not. Now that looks like a covenant to them. When they came out of Egypt and came to Mount Sinai Exodus, the 19th chapter and then the 20th chapter, where there he claimed that his people had made the covenant of the Ten Commandments. Then over in Exodus 24, 1-8, here when Moses went up and received the law and came down, and the covenant, he read it in the ears of the people, and they said, all that Jehovah commanded we will do and be obedient. Then he took the blood of bulls and goats and sprinkled the people, and according to Hebrews 9, sprinkled the book of the covenant. That brought them into a blood covenant with God, blood of goats and bulls there, in which God has promised to do certain things for them, but it demands certain things of them. Now, in the 26th chapter of Leviticus and the 28th chapter of Deuteronomy, there we have the blessings and the curse. The blessings were conditioned on keeping the covenant. The curse was the punishment if you don't keep the covenant. So now then God's calling that to their mind about nearly 1,000 years later, after they've come back 900 years, in the time of Moses there. Now he's calling their attention to the covenant that he has made. Now, you remember this, God is going to keep his part of the covenant. It's up to me to keep my part of the covenant. You have the same parallel in the New Testament. He would say, this is my blood of the new covenant. I come into relationship with that covenant when I reach the blood, when I'm baptized into the death of Christ. There I come to the death of Christ. I come to the blood of Christ. There I'm sealed under God in a blood covenant in which he has promised me the remission of sins. He's promised me his abiding presence. He promised me a resurrection. He promised me heaven on the ground of faithfulness. Now then, I hear and understand what he said. I agree to it. Now, it's up to me to keep my part of the covenant. If God's going to keep his part of it. That's always been true of Jehovah and his people. He makes a covenant, I keep my part of it. And now then, you're going to have to keep yours part of it. So that's what he's saying here now. When he says here, according to the word which I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, and my spirit abode among you, fear ye not. I think you've got three fine thoughts you have to remember. First of all, be strong. Be strong and work, and fear not. Fear nothing, but put your faith in God. If you're strong in the Lord, you have nothing to fear. If a man isn't, well, you've got God to fear. So here are the three great words that I hope I can impress upon you this morning. First of all, be strong here. All right? Now be strong and what? And work and fear not. That principle is just as good to follow today as it was back there with Haggai. And that's still the principle. We're going to be strong in the Lord and the strength of his might, says Paul. Right, so we're strong in him, then work. The work the works of him that sent me wanted today, the night comes when no man can work. And fear not. Don't be afraid of any force or any power on earth, whether it's communism or whether it's atheism or whether it's humanism or whether it's whatever you want to call it, politics or whatever it is. Don't fear anything. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole of man. I guess my time's about up. So I'll stop there. I want to finish this chapter next time. Now, maybe you want to go back and review a little bit on the background of this, because the same background will apply to Zechariah when we get to Haggai and come to it. It's just he's just a few months later. Just a few months after Haggai was called, God called him then to work with, as a younger man, to work with Haggai. And he didn't even want to mention the other. You get that from what they did at the time place there. Any question before I quit? Any question at all?